Welcome to the Economics Explained podcast. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. Last week, I spoke about what economists do and what value they add to the world. I'm going to expand on that in this episode, where I'm going to be looking at the role of economics in the public policy process and drilling down into that. And to speak about that, with me, I've invited my colleague at Adept Economics, Ben Scott, back onto the show. Ben, good to be speaking with you again.
Thank you for having me on again, Gene.
Pleasure, Ben. Ben, I'd like to talk about economics and public policy today, and I'd like to speak about the policy pitch competition that one of the organisations you're involved in, the UQ, I better make sure I get this right, Economics Society, is involved in it. Also, Adept Economics, my business, is sponsoring it. Would you be able to explain what the competition is about, please, Ben?
Yeah, sure. So this is a case study competition for university students attending the University of Queensland. And what the competition is asking students to do is to propose a policy solution to a given set of policy issues. They've been given 1 week to respond and come up with a response. And then from a batch of from the registered teams that do end up submitting a final response, finalists will be chosen to present in front of judges who, in addition to yourself, also belong to various schools within the University of Queensland. And ultimately, the competition is just about fostering some friendly competition among students who are interested in public policy and really interested in public policy as potential career path.
Okay. And we'll be talking a bit later about what the different tools of public policy are. Broadly, we're talking about things that the government can do to influence outcomes it's interested in, to maximise community well-being. So what are those policy issues that, or what are the questions that are being asked? What are the different issues that you're looking for policy responses on, Ben?
So there are a few. I know one is homelessness. Another one is, I think, food shortages, and a third I'm unsure of, actually.
Unemployment in COVID?
It could have been. It probably was. I haven't actually seen the final list myself, Gene.
That's okay. You said it to me, so that's okay. It was in the document. Now, some of these are very challenging problems, aren't they? Well, let's take homelessness, for example. You have to understand, well, why are people homeless to begin with? And there's a whole host of, or, you know, a wide range of reasons why people could end up homeless, and a lot of things have to go wrong in your life. You might need a very comprehensive policy solution to that. I don't think we've worked it out yet, because there are still homeless people even in a prosperous country like Australia with a really good social welfare system. So you need to look at mental health services, I suppose, and alcohol and drug treatment. So that's a really challenging one. I think that's why that may have been one I suggested, because, you know, I see it all the time in Spring Hill, where our office is. We do have a lot of homeless people up in the park on Wickham Terrace, and I often think, well, what possible solutions would there be? So I think that's a really good one to talk about. And so you have the students prepare a briefing, is that right? And they produce a 1 to 2 page note, and then we get them to present their the policies, ideas that they've developed.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a real emphasis on, you know, the sort of policy frameworks that they're that they're referring to, and also in the, you know, the nitty-gritty of the quantitative aspects of how they're using economics to actually inform their ultimate policy solutions.
Exactly, yeah. And so this is something that I spoke with some of the students about on Monday. So there's a YouTube video of that available, and I can put a link to it in the show notes, which has the slides that I presented. And in that presentation, what I tried to do was to brief the participants on what a really well-crafted policy proposal looks like, and how you'd use economic tools to develop that. And I began with the thought that economics has become the language of government, particularly in Australia here, and I think in many other countries. If you're going to get a policy idea advanced and get it approved by decision makers, by the politicians, this could be a new investment project, it could be a new irrigation dam, or it could be a policy to promote solar PV on houses. Could be a wide range of, could be any sort of policy proposal where you're asking the government to commit resources, to spend money, or to impose a charge, or to impose a regulation that tells people they need to do something. So, for example, in Southeast Queensland here, many years ago, we had a government that made it mandatory for houses to have, for new houses, to have a 5 kiloliter rainwater tank because we were worried about water shortages. Now, if you're going to do that sort of thing, increasingly you need to crunch the numbers, you need to demonstrate that the policy proposal is sensible, that it stacks up. You may need to provide estimates of jobs that are created or lost because of the policy proposal. And economists are incredibly important in that process. And that's something I chatted about with my friend Tim Hughes last week. So economics has become the language of government, and it's become that, I think, because, well, since the 80s, after all the economic chaos of the 70s in many Western countries, we realised the importance of having well-run economies, of having sound economic frameworks, of not spending unwisely, of keeping our public budgets under control. And so economists have become increasingly important in analysing policies and making sure they stack up. And I've seen that up close. I worked in the Treasury in Canberra, so that the Treasury is the main economic agency, the main economic ministry in Australia. It's equivalent to the US Treasury. It's equivalent to HM Treasury in England, in the UK. And it's equivalent to what's called the Finance Ministry, Ministry of Finance in some other countries such as Germany, Japan, Indonesia. And so one of my jobs there was I was in the fiscal group. I was in industry policy and also in budget policy, and we would review all of the various policy proposals that come from different agencies. They'd be putting in a new policy proposal. We want this much money to spend on this particular project or program. And I remember when I was there, there were a huge variety of things, and they'd be looking for money for for new sporting facilities, for example. It could be an aerial skiing center, or it could be a community program. It could be a program. There was one program where they were looking to fund, I think, like a soccer competition for homeless people. I remember that was one idea. So there are a wide variety of programs, and the ones that typically get accepted are ones where it's solving a real problem or it's meeting a community need. It looks well developed. It looks well designed. It looks like it's not going to be a waste of money. It looks like it's going to achieve its outcomes. And there'll be evidence that backs it up. And some of that evidence can be from economists. It can be evidence of the net benefits of the program via a cost-benefit analysis, or it could be evidence of how many jobs it'll create via an economic impact analysis, how many dollars of value added it'll introduce into the economy. Ben, do you have any questions following that general intro I've given? Any thoughts on that?
No, not really. I guess one thing that does come to mind, though, is just how important economists are in, you know, looking through the, I guess, empirical evidence, which ties back to one of the difficulties of homelessness, an issue that you were talking about earlier. You know, it's very difficult to, I think, push through policy proposals without that sound body of evidence, which is why economists have become so prominent in the public sphere.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so what I told the participants is that what I'd like to see is in their one-page briefing enough analysis, enough discussion of the issue, and the identification of a clear problem, some analysis of the problem, and a nicely developed solution or policy idea where they've thought about what the inputs are, how it's going to be delivered, what outputs and what outcomes they're going for, what they hope to achieve from it, and what the cost of it will be. Think about what the resources involved will be. And in the YouTube video, in the presentation that I gave on Monday, I showed an example of an actual policy proposal. Well, when it got to the budget stage, when it's been reported as a budget measure, and what you'll see is that in each financial year, they identify how many dollars, or typically millions of dollars, for Australian government programs are going to a particular agency for a particular program. And the example I gave was this agriculture stewardship package, which was a program of the Department of Agriculture and Water Resources in Australia, $34 million program over 4 years. They give a breakdown of what they're going to be spending in each of the years. And it's a good example of a program which has been informed by economists. This is a program whereby they're essentially paying farmers to look after the land because they recognise that farmers have the option of clearing land or perhaps neglecting land. They could possibly neglect land because they're focused on, well, growing crops and making money from that, supporting themselves and their families. So they may need an incentive to look after the land and to protect biodiversity. So this is an example of a market-based solution, a market-based mechanism. And I think one of the great contributions that economics has made, and this is something I chatted about with Boyd Blackwell, my old friend from UQ many years ago, one of the great contributions that economics has made is in developing these market-based solutions to policy problems in the environmental area. So this is a really good example of that. Okay. So what I stressed to the participants in that briefing was that what we want to see is the logic. We want to be very clear about the logic behind a policy proposal. And I referred them to a really great diagram from the Productivity Commission, which was in a report they did on gambling. Now, gambling's a contentious issue in Australia because politicians and community leaders are worried that people spend all their money on the pokies, on the poker machines, the slot machines. They get addicted to it and they don't have enough money to live on, and they're worried about all of the social consequences of that. So there's been a lot of analysis of gambling and what can be done, what sort of regulations can be applied, and then what can be done with the proceeds of gambling taxes, how they can be spent on programs to help people who get into trouble. And the Productivity Commission, which is an Australian government agency, it's a statutory authority, it's independent of the government, it will get terms of reference from the government, from the Treasurer, who is equivalent to the Treasury Secretary in the United States. It will get terms of reference from the Treasurer to investigate important public policy issues, and it will do the research and develop very rigorous recommendations and policy recommendations on specific topics. And it's been incredibly influential over the years in Australia. It helped, it provided the blueprint for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, for example. So what I did was I provided this diagram. I'll put it in the show notes. I think it's a great diagram. It talks about how the important thing is to first identify a problem and a rationale for an intervention. So there actually has to be a problem. Sometimes we see things and we think, oh, well, we don't like that. We don't like that outcome, but is it actually a serious problem? You have to agree that there is a problem that needs addressing. And well, let's take homelessness for example. It's possible that there could always be a level of homelessness in the community that you're just never going to be able to address. There'll always be people at any one time who for some reason or another are temporarily out of a home. It's just bad luck that's going to happen. You may not be able to prevent all homelessness, just as you can't prevent all unemployment. There's always going to be frictional unemployment. So you have to first work out, is there actually a problem to be addressed that government can do something about? Homelessness may not have been the best example, but I'm just trying to emphasise that you need to make sure there's a problem that the government really needs to respond to. Ben, do you have any thoughts on that? I don't want to sound heartless in some of those comments, but do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I understand what you're getting at, but I can't think up of an example off the top of my head where, you know, government tried to really intervene in an area where it probably wasn't needed and that resulted in something really bad happening.
Okay.
But
well, I can give an example of a policy area where government thought it needed to intervene and then it turned out it really didn't need to intervene. And there was this idea back in the Rudd government. So this was a government in Australia in the late 2000s. And it was concerned about cost of living. And it had this idea to bring in this thing called Grocery Watch, which would be a website that would collate all of the prices of different goods and services, actually primarily goods, I think, at supermarkets, and compare them so consumers could see which you know, where the goods were cheapest, and this, the idea was to promote competition. But they had all sorts of technical problems with getting this up off the ground, if I remember correctly. And it turned out it was really unnecessary to begin with, I think. And it was abandoned. We don't have Grocery Watch anymore. I think this is a good example of a policy where, if you thought about it, well, actually, is there a problem? Do we have a problem of with the prices in the supermarket? And I'd have to say probably not. I mean, there are lots of different options, lots of different places to shop. Supermarket prices generally seem reasonable. I guess there has been a concern in Australia about the duopoly, so-called duopoly with Coles and Woolworths, so that could have been part of the concern. But when the ACCC's looked at it, so that's our competition regulator, it's concluded that they really haven't been abusing market power. So I think that could be an example of one where there wasn't really a rationale for intervention.
Yeah, definitely. And perhaps just more broadly, any attempt to kind of centrally manage markets,
exactly, I guess,
has, you know, in history has had really adverse effects, and probably contrary to perhaps the good intentions of those governments. But yeah.
Absolutely. So competition is the great regulator. That's the, you know, I think that's something you often hear. So very good point. Okay. So we'll move on to the, you know, more parts of this flowchart, which I'll put in the show notes. You have to work out whether the problem is big enough, develop some clear policy objectives. What are you trying to achieve with your policy? Develop options for policy action, analyze the impacts and net benefits. And this is where economists really become helpful with their analysis of net benefits versus of projects, so looking at the benefits, trying to quantify as many of those benefits as possible, so both the economic benefits and social benefits. There could be improvements in health that come about as a result of a program. So if you were looking at a program to get people off the streets to reduce homelessness, you would be attempting to quantify the savings in, ultimately the savings in healthcare costs, which might come from having people get off the streets and being healthier. There could be other savings, and certainly the people who get off the streets, if they can get into housing and then they can get a job, then they're contributing to the economy. You could attempt to value that. So that what you'd be doing is looking at quantifying as many benefits and costs of your program as possible and determining whether there's a net benefit. So bringing as much evidence as possible, and that can be data, it can be views from consultations to help you develop assumptions for your model. Now, I think you listened to my chat with John Kay, didn't you? So one of the eminent British economist, and he was saying that if you're doing this economic modelling, look at those variables, look at the parameters that are incredibly important, and put a lot of effort into coming up with sensible parameter values, sensible assumptions. So do the research to develop those assumptions, and then you'll get really good evidence to guide your decisions. Okay, and then after we figure out what the best option is based on our analysis, government would implement that assuming they tick it off because they see, okay, this delivers a lot of value. So it might be, say it's a new dam, for example, a new irrigation dam, and the government says, oh, this is going to deliver a lot of additional value in terms of agricultural production, and that's going to help stimulate the regional economy. That could provide jobs for long-term unemployed people. It could reduce mental health problems if this is a community that's under pressure. after all this is done, there should be a review process of some kind. So increasingly, what we're seeing in public policy is this emphasis on monitoring programs of, and evaluating them. So regularly reviewing them to make sure that you're achieving what you want to achieve, and then revising them if as necessary, or perhaps scrapping them. So in Australia, I remember one of the major savings that the Rudd government made when it got into power in 2007-08 in Australia, it scrapped what was called the Commercial Ready Program, which was a government commercialization scheme. And that was because there was evidence that that program wasn't delivering results. It just wasn't very effective. They actually weren't able to find a lot of companies that they could provide this assistance to. There just weren't a lot of companies that met the criteria. And so, if I remember correctly, it was rather heavily undersubscribed. And so this was a bit of a failure as a program. So it was reviewed, may have been by the Productivity Commission. I think they mentioned it in, or they looked at it in one of their inquiry reports. And then that was evidence that the government used to take that money from Commercial Ready and develop a new innovation program. And it developed something rather interesting called Enterprise Connect, which was a program whereby they provided grants, so small grants to manufacturing businesses, so businesses creating a product, and they provide grants to help them progress an idea. And that could be testing a prototype, for example. It could be doing a study into the economics of the of a particular product, the savings that it could provide to customers. And I actually helped out a client who accessed money through Enterprise Connect to demonstrate the cost effectiveness of their product, which was a artificial turf product. So that's an example of where governments have reviewed projects, they've looked at the evidence, some of it produced by economists, and found a better way to do things. Any thoughts on that, Ben? Comments, questions?
Not in particular. I guess it just brings up, it could bring up the, you know, interesting question regarding, you know, different time horizons, because there are some policy solutions that seem to be working out short term, then over the long term they have a, you know, contradictory effect to what was intended. But yeah, the review process is definitely an important one, because you want to really make sure you're correcting your mistakes, I guess, if you're, you know, implementing policy at such a large scale.
Yep, absolutely. Okay. So before we move on to some examples of different policies, we might just chat about this issue of the rationale for intervention and also some of the value judgments that get made in providing advice on policy. This was something I emphasised. I wanted course participants, I wanted the competition participants to be mindful of any value judgments they're making, because often when we're giving advice on what to do, we're not always explicit about what our value judgments are. Economists typically say that if governments are going to intervene, they can either do so because A, there's an identified market failure, so the market has failed to provide the optimal outcome. That's a legitimate grounds for intervention. Alternatively, they could intervene on equity grounds. And this is where the value judgments become important. And this is where economists have to be careful. I mean, we have to be explicit about what value judgments we're making. So I'll try to address these points now. Economists typically argue you want to see if you want to intervene, it needs to be in the case of a market failure, and that's because economists have a model of competitive markets which suggests, so under very specific assumptions and very restrictive assumptions, it turns out that the market outcome is ideal, that it's the outcome that maximizes community welfare. And so therefore, if the government is going to intervene, there has to be a specific departure from that perfectly competitive economic model to justify that intervention. And there have been several types of market failures that have been identified, and I think we'll try to cover each of these in a future episode of this podcast. Incidentally, if you're listening in the audience, I should flag that I'll have to change the name of this podcast in the future, possibly to something like Economics Explored, because I've discovered recently that I've inadvertently given it the same name as a popular YouTube channel, but I'll deal with that in a future episode. Regarding the different types of market failure, there are public goods, so there are goods such as a lighthouse or national defence. You can argue that if you don't have government providing it, there'd be free riders. There could be externalities such as pollution, whereby you've got businesses polluting the environment, so a river, or they're pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and that contributes to climate change. And that could be a scope for government intervention. They call those external costs, externalities. There could be information asymmetries. There could be gaps in knowledge. Governments might want to regulate to prevent consumers from being ripped off, and that's why there are very strict regulations around financial advice and investments in many countries. There are all sorts of regulations around to protect consumers and investors where there are information asymmetries. Okay. So that's one grounds for, those are the grounds for intervention. So this concept of market failure. We need to recognize that economists are making a value judgment that if a policy should be adopted, if it provides net benefits to the community as we measure net benefits. So economists often, well, as I mentioned, we try to quantify everything, quantify benefits in terms of dollars, quantify costs in terms of dollars, look at whether in the aggregate, benefits exceed the costs. And economists would typically say, well, if in the aggregate, benefits exceed the costs, then a policy should go ahead. But implicit in that is an assumption that what we're interested in is we're aggregating welfare, we're aggregating all of the welfare functions of individuals to get this group welfare, and we're saying that if something improves group welfare, then that's something that should proceed. So we're actually making a value judgment there that we should just look at the whole community and ignore individuals, which could many people could think is abhorrent. And that's why there was an economist who, and some, you know, economists are, there are economists who would, who find this abhorrent. There was an economist who, well, a famous economist called Pareto, and his criterion for a, to assess whether a particular change in the economy was desirable or not was to look at it, whether this is something that makes no one worse off. It can make some people better off, can leave other people the same, but it means that no one's worse off. And if there's something that does that, then it should proceed. It's seen as something that's desirable. And often trade is seen as being Pareto optimal because people wouldn't engage in trade. They wouldn't buy and sell from each other if it wasn't mutually beneficial. This was Adam Smith's argument in favour of a free market. Okay. Now, this can become problematic because you can have policies that do improve community welfare if you're adding up, let's call it utility, well-being across a range of individuals. There could be some individuals who are worse off, even though everyone's better off. There's a famous theory in economics. It's called the Keldor-Hicks criterion. And what it argued is that as long as there's a potential Pareto improvement, as long as theoretically the winners could compensate the losers, which would be the case if you have net benefits, you work out that there are net benefits of a policy proposal, then theoretically if the winners could compensate the losers, then you should proceed with it. And as I discussed with Tim last week, the argument for free trade, the argument for entering into trade agreements such as NAFTA, is that these agreements are going to improve the economy. They're actually going to lead to lower prices for consumers. They're going to grow the pie, and theoretically we could, you know, everyone could get more pie. The problem is with any policy change, there may be people who are worse off. And in the US, we've seen that people who've lost their jobs as manufacturing has moved to other countries such as Mexico or to China, we see that those people have been worse off and they haven't really necessarily been compensated. So what I've told the course participants, competition participants, is you need to think about who's affected and what value judgments you're making when you're developing your policy. Are you assuming that if the community, in measuring the well-being of the community via a cost-benefit analysis, if you're assuming that there are net benefits according to that cost-benefit analysis, that it's a desirable policy, well, okay, that's what tends to happen. That tends to be a value judgment that's made, that you can look at community welfare in that way. But just be careful about that. Ideally, do a distributional analysis. Look at how different groups in the community are affected, and then think about whether you need to enact additional measures to address any equity concerns that come about. And keep in mind that earlier I said that, you know, equity can be seen by some as a legitimate grounds for government intervention. That's a value judgment some people make. Economists are making their own, some specific value judgments, and I think we need to be clear about those. We should be clear that generally we're looking at this community welfare, we're being Benthamites. So going back to Jeremy Bentham, the great philosopher, the great English philosopher, who argued that the the role of government, what government should be doing is providing the or seeking the greatest good or the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. I think this discussion is relevant in this time of COVID because we've imposed policies, we've imposed restrictions on the community to protect people, which is as you would, which is ideal. I think we do need to protect people. There's an argument in some places, particularly in Victoria, which is the state of Australia at the moment, that the government has gone too far with its curfews that it's put in place. It's very heavy-handed restrictions. You could argue that the government's actually not achieving the greatest good for the greatest number. And some economists have been involved in this debate. I think I've discussed this with Joe Brannigan previously on this program. If you've listened to those discussions, you'll know what I'm talking about. I'm trying to emphasise that we need to distinguish between positive and normative economics. We need to think positive economics looks at impacts, looks at the facts. Normative economics is where we try to jump from our analysis to recommendations. Just need to be clear about that. What value judgments are we making? How are we solving that is-ought problem from David Hume? David Hume famously identified that you can't go from statements about what is in the world to what ought to be without making a normative premise, without making some sort of value judgment. Okay, Ben, how was that? Does that all make sense, or was that a bit rambling?
No. I thought it touched on everything.
Okay. The more I think about this, the more I realise just how challenging it is, and how many assumptions as economists we're making in our analysis and our advice. And we often jump to making recommendations, but we don't think through why we're making those recommendations. So for example, and this is an example I gave in the presentation on Monday, when the Abbott government got into power in Australia in 2013-14, it brought in a commission of audit. It established a commission of audit to look at government programs because they were concerned about debt that had built up. And this commission of audit recommended large cuts to public spending and privatisation of different agencies, policies. A lot of there were policies I thought were great. I thought, well, this is good. This is the sort of thing that Treasury would have recommended. This is the sort of thing that when I was in Treasury, we were recommending. We were recommending government be very cautious in spending money, that it looks after taxpayers' funds, that it goes for value for money. And we would be recommending that government gets out of some of the activities that it was still in, that it shouldn't be in the Treasury's view, where there are private sector providers who could do the job. The problem was the community reaction to the Abbott government's first budget when Joe Hockey was the treasurer, and you may recall at the time there was that famous image of Joe Hockey smoking a cigar. So Joe Hockey was the treasurer at the time, later Australia's ambassador to the US. And it was just a bad look. It just looked really bad because when you looked at the budget, and one of my former classmates at University of Queensland, Ben Phillips, who has gone on to become an associate professor at the Australian National University, he demonstrated using his micro simulation models that the budget repair, the savings that the government was making and the additional charges it was imposing to repair the budget, and this included a co-payment for Medicare, so that's our public health scheme. If you visit I think if you had more than 10 visits in a month or something, you had to start paying $7 for your visit. It couldn't just be bulk billed, whereby if it's bulk billed, well, you just give them your Medicare card. This is if you visit the doctor and you don't have to pay anything. The government picks it up. What Ben showed was, this is Ben Phillips, what he showed was that all of the pain was going to be experienced by low-income earners, and most of the pain. And so people saw this as an unfair budget, even though economists might say, well, actually, this is what the government should be doing. It's very sensible. The Medicare co-payment is going to prevent overuse of the public health system. We do need to think about the cost of that system. The problem was it was seen as very unfair, and they weren't able to get a lot of that budget wasn't able to get through. So I think that's a good example of where you do need to think about the distinction between positive and normative economics. Think about value judgments. Think about equity. As economists, we can advise on the economics of projects, of policies. We just need to recognise that ultimately it's the politicians who have to make the decisions, make the value judgments on behalf of the community. Any questions on that, Ben? Any thoughts?
No. That was clear to me.
Okay. I think we're actually running close to time. And we've still got a few things to chat about. I did want to talk about the Australian Treasury's wellbeing framework, maybe, and the wellbeing budget from New Zealand. We might have to chat about that in a future episode. Also, different types of interventions. I mentioned before this issue of climate change or pollution. And often the tool that's advanced to control that is, it's an economic financial tool. It's the carbon tax or an emissions trading scheme. This could be seen as a form of corrective taxation, of Pigouvian taxation after Pigou, the Cambridge economist who was a teacher of Keynes. Actually, might have been a contemporary. They were both students of Alfred Marshall. Let me look that up just to make sure. But he wrote a book called The Economics of Welfare. And the idea of imposing a corrective tax on something you don't like to reduce the use of it or to reduce pollution, or so a carbon tax, or to reduce smoking, so to reduce there could be a tax on cigarettes. That can be seen as what they call a sin tax. A tax on sin, likewise excise on alcohol could be seen as a sin tax. So these are tools that can be very effective. The flip side of a corrective tax is a subsidy. But you have to be sure that you're subsidising something that is worthwhile and it's not a waste of money. On other types of economic measures that can be imposed are things like this no jab, no pay measure that we've imposed in Australia, whereby we require anyone who's getting a childcare benefit, if they've got children, they have to ensure that they've been immunised for, measles and mumps. So the diseases that we're able to immunise against. So that's one tool that can be very effective. I also talked about different types of interventions, and I'll put this chart in the show notes where we look at public provision. That's one option, but that can be very expensive. It's often better for governments to provide an economic or financial tool. Like it's instead of the government providing public housing, for example, it's often cheaper for governments to provide rental assistance, and then that can help address concerns about housing, people not being able to get housing without getting the government involved in providing the housing and then having all of the associated costs with that and the inefficiency of that. So there are often better tools than governments directly doing things. the other interventions are things like regulation. As I mentioned, you could force people to install rainwater tanks. Sometimes it can be appropriate to have regulations where governments are they want to achieve a certain outcome, such as safety. They want to make it mandatory that amusement devices, so say the DC Rivals Hypercoaster at Movie World, they'll require that amusement devices need to have a major inspection, whereby they essentially they tick off on every part of the device every 10 years or so. They pull it apart. They do a strip down rebuild, they call it. That's one idea. That's one type of approach. You could regulate it. You could make it law that they legally have to do it, force them to do it. And you could argue, well, in some circumstances, it's good to do that because there's such a great benefit to public safety. But as we know, regulations can be costly to the community. All the red tape, it can prevent development, it can impose costs on businesses, cost jobs. You have to be really careful that it actually delivers a community benefit. The other type of intervention is suasion. You could try to persuade people to do the right thing. That can be very difficult. It's only where there's really a clear message and people get it, they understand it, or it's an emotional message. I gave the example of the campaign in Australia against cigarette smoking, whereby that was very effective because you had images of a grandfather and he couldn't pick up his granddaughter because he had emphysema or he had lung problems because he was a heavy smoker. And that really shocked people, really moved people to quit smoking. And there are other ads like that resonated. That was a very effective campaign. I also mentioned in the briefing how it wasn't just suasion with the cigarettes, targeting cigarettes. It was also a sin tax, so really jacking up the excise on tobacco, and that's increased the price. And it is so expensive to smoke now. So in Australia, I think, what is it, $25-$30 for a pack of cigarettes? It's just absolutely incredible. Luckily, I've never really smoked, but I don't know how anyone can afford to smoke. Many years ago, there were people smoking, there were all these pack-a-day smokers. But if you do that now, I mean, you'll go broke. It's extraordinary. Okay, Ben, I think we've probably covered enough ground for this episode. What do you think?
Sounds like a day.
I think so. Oh, the final point I want to make is the issue of unintended consequences. If you're designing policy, just make sure you don't get any unintended consequences or perverse outcomes. And arguably, we had that in Australia recently with the JobKeeper, the wage subsidy. And the way they designed that with a $1,500 flat payment, it meant that some people ended up earning more on the JobKeeper than they would have previously, particularly some part-time and casual workers. And not all of those workers ended up increasing their hours to justify the additional wage. I mean, many did, have done the right thing, but there have been concerns in the community that this has been a bit of a rort. So the government in Australia is fixing that up in the next iteration of JobKeeper. Okay, Ben, thanks so much for your time and for the conversation. I've found that really valuable. I hope you have too. This is trying to explain this and how I think about it helps me think about this more clearly. So thanks for participating.
No worries. It was a pleasure, Jim.
Thank you. We've reached the end of another Economics Explained episode, so thanks for listening all the way through. If you're enjoying Economics Explained, please tell your family and friends and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or on whatever platform you are listening on. Finally, if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please get in touch. My email address is gene.tunney@gmail.com. Until next week, goodbye.